From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis joins me for an update on Syria. We'll talk about the rise of the Islamic State and this week's murder of journalist James Foley.
They're trying to use the same tactics they've used on the ground, and people have submitted to them and joined them because they can't fight them. And so America has to decide, do we really want to get into this, or do we want to try to contain them?
And later, this month's 100th anniversary of the opening of the Panama Canal.
Back then, this was sort of on the same scale as wanting to build an elevator to orbit today.
It's like a one-hour travel, but you have five types of rainforest in the middle.
We'll talk about international shipping and why the 48-mile-long channel is still an engineering and environmental marvel, right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Joshua Landis, welcome back to the roundtable.
Well, it's great to be back with you again, Suzette.
We've missed you this summer. So we clearly need an update on Syria and Iraq and what's going on with this group, the Islamic State, once known by the acronym ISIS, I guess. This week, the horrible beheading of the American reporter James Foley, the news prior to that of trapping this ethnic group, the Yazidi, up on the mountains and torturing and killing many of them. What is going on here? Help us make some sense out of the developments that are going on right now in Syria and Iraq.
Well, Syria, as we all know, has been locked in this terrible civil war. The state and the Assad government have not collapsed, but they have retreated from much of the eastern part of the country. And ISIS, this Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, which began as al-Qaeda in Iraq, we didn't completely destroy them, but we certainly beat them back. But increasingly, they moved over into Syria once Syria state collapsed, and they gestated there. And then we saw this spring a dramatic sweeping of ISIS through Iraq. So today they own a third of Syria and Iraq, an area the size of Maryland that is big. This is a big state. So finally, the jihadists have created their own state. And they've been using this head-chopping technique, terror, in order to intimidate people. And a tribe that resisted them in Deir ez-Zor, an area in Syria, 800 of their male members had their heads chopped off in revenge. And this is such a dramatic show.
And this is in retaliation. You said revenge. In retaliation for what exactly?
Because
the U.S. airstrikes, the
Foley thing
the
is revenge for the airstrikes. Mm-hmm. And they're letting America know. And they said, we've got other reporters and we're going to chop their heads off too. So if you want to get in here, you know, they're trying to use the same tactics they've used on the ground successfully against Syrian tribes and other rebels, which is to terrify them. And people have submitted to them and joined them because they can't fight them. And so America has to decide, do we really want to get into this, or do we want to try to contain them? And that's the big issue that America is really contemplating today.
Well, and you said Assad has basically retreated. I mean, there's some discussion now, right, about actually the United States working with the Syrian regime to try and fight this group. I mean, is this now kind of a reversal of fortunes perhaps for
it is a reversal
Assad
of
regime?
And it shows you how desperate we've become, because we were helping the rebels and we've been arming and particularly diplomatic and humanitarian help for the rebel side, which has caused the state to partially collapse in Syria. And instead of getting democracy, we've got ISIS that has taken advantage of this failed state to grow up. This happened in Iraq too. It shouldn't be a surprise. It happened in Afghanistan. It's happened in Libya. So the immediate question is, if you want to rebuild a state, do you go to Assad? And Assad today, unfortunately, is the only power that seems capable of doing it. There are 1,000 rebel militias, and there are people advocating that we give more money to the militias and more arms, and hopefully they could conquer both Assad and ISIS. But that seems to me fewer and fewer people are talking that way, because the militias have been incompetent, divided, fighting amongst each other, and their incompetence has led to the rise of ISIS. So, but Assad is not a good choice. But when faced with these horrible choices, Assad or ISIS, few people are going to choose ISIS.
So Assad is the lesser of two evils perhaps. And so what do we see happening there? I mean, is this actually going to be a legitimate option for the United States government?
You know, I doubt the U.S. government is going to team up with Assad. it would damage U.S. reputation tremendously. The president said Assad has to step aside. Chances are Obama will contain in Syria. He's going to try to hurt ISIS badly and roll them back in Iraq because we have partners in Iraq. We have the Kurdish Peshmerga and we have this new prime minister that we seem to be holding a lot of stock by, Abadi, in Baghdad. We don't have partners in Syria. Push them out of Iraq, contain them in Syria. That's been our strategy for the last 3.5 years. Contain violence in Syria. Don't try to solve it. And chances are Obama's going to stick to his script.
Thank you so much, Joshua, for being with us today. As always, for your insight about this important part of the world.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear from you about this program, and we'll try to answer any questions you might have. You can leave your comments on our website or the KGOU Facebook page, or send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzette Gralat, and at Joshua_Landis. Coming up, I'll talk with two historians and an environmentalist about this month's centennial of the opening of the Panama Canal. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. A week ago today marked 100 years since the Panama Canal opened. France started the project in 1881, but abandoned it due to engineering difficulties and outbreaks of malaria and yellow fever. The United States took over the project in 1904 and completed it 10 years later, with the first ships passing through on August 15, 1914. I'm joined today by three experts on the 48-mile shipping channel. Noel Maurer is a professor at Harvard's Business School and the author of The Big Ditch, How America Took, Built, Ran, and Ultimately Gave Away the Panama Canal. Julie Green teaches history at the University of Maryland and wrote The Canal Builders, Making America's Empire at the Panama Canal. And environmentalist Risa Banfield, who was elected the vice mayor of Panama's capital city earlier this year. She took office July 1st. Risa Banfield, Julie Green, and Noel Maurer, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We're celebrating, I suppose, over 100 years of the Panama Canal. And it's just a fascinating project. Obviously, everybody knows what this is all about, but don't really know the details. And so maybe, Noel, you could start by giving us a little bit of history about the canal. Kind of, you know, when did people start paying attention? I mean, this goes back much further than, of course, the United States completing the canal in the early 1900s.
So, there are attempts to cross Panama and important economic routes crossing Panama all the way back to the 17th century. And there were ideas to build canals also all the way back to the 17th century. Of course, back then, this was sort of on the same scale as wanting to build an elevator to orbit today. It was a little bit ahead of the engineering capacity of the time. The Panama Railroad opens up in the mid-19th century, and that's certainly a big deal for Panama, although it would be an exaggeration to say it was really that important for the United States economically or politically, as opposed to in terms of literature, where a lot of really good stories apparently get written by people going over the Panama Railroad or on their way to and from the Panama Railroad. The canal itself, the big construction effort, the first one is by the French in the 1880s, and it is, to put it mildly, a complete and total disaster. They're attempting to build at first a sea-level lock canal, which involves excavating way too much dirt, essentially, than was feasible at the time or would even be feasible today. They eventually redesign it to be a lock canal, but it never occurs to the engineers on the French canal that they can use the Panama Railroad to truck out the dirt. Instead, what they do is they just kind of plonk it down on the sides of the excavation, where during the rainy season you get rain and then you get muddy pools where they've excavated all of this dirt, which means you then get mosquitoes, which means you get malaria, which means your workforce does not do very well. So this was a total disaster, and eventually they stop construction. And so they had a 20-year concession, and the clock was running out on their concession towards the early 20th century. It was slated to expire in 1904. And you've got the shareholders in this French company are sitting on $40 million of investments there. the United States gets interested in building a canal after the Spanish-American War. You've now got Hawaii and the Philippines. There's sort of some strategic interest in a canal. There's always been economic interest, but this sort of catalyzes the politicians to get involved. And I don't want to get too much into it, although I will if there's a follow-up on it. But essentially, that's where you get the kind of sleazy deal to cleave Panama off from Colombia. And a lot of that deal has to do with the fact that the Colombians know that if they wait until 1904, that $40 million worth of assets sitting on the ground will revert to them, and the $40 million the United States is going to pay for them. Just to give you some idea, today, relative to the economy, it's about $5 billion. So this is not monopoly money. Mm-hmm. So the Colombians are just procrastinating and waiting and engaging in these negotiating strategies that are slowly but surely driving President Teddy Roosevelt, who's not the most patient of men anyway, up the wall. Now, they're waiting for a reason. But Roosevelt's patience runs out in 1903. There's a meeting in the Waldorf Astoria between a Panamanian revolutionary, a fellow named Amador, a lawyer from the French company, and a representative of the U.S. government. A check for $100,000 is cut. The date when Panama will declare its independence is announced. American warships are fortuitously in the area. Panama becomes independent. The Canal Zone Treaty is signed, and the United States begins construction of the canal. And the canal turns out to be monumentally, phenomenally economically important to the United States, but for reasons which nobody expected. So the first thing I want to say here is it goes over budget and construction by a factor of two and opens 7 years late. There's this weird myth that, you know, somehow back then we could do things faster and better and cheaper, and that's not true. The canal does finally open, though, and it turns out that it's phenomenally important to the California oil industry. Most of the cargo moving through the canal through its first 20 years is oil moving from the West Coast of California to the East Coast of the United States, and this produces massive economic benefits for the United States. Again, relative to the size of the economy, that's about the equivalent of $250 billion today in essentially cost savings. There's also big drops in oil prices on the East Coast of the United States. This is hugely important. But after World War II, and I don't know if I should keep going, its importance to the U.S. starts to drop precipitously. But before World War II, it's a huge deal.
So clearly the economic impact is tremendous, as you've said. But I want to pick up on something you said and actually turn to Risa now and talk about the environmental impact. I mean, you're talking about all the dirt and all the – you know, you read about the amount of earth that was moved in order to create this canal. So the engineering part of it, incredible, absolutely incredible. But the environmental impact is also incredible. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Even with my bad English, sorry for that, but I tried to explain myself. But one of the things of the environmental impact of the Panama Canal route is on the forest. Panama is one of the 26 hot spots of biodiversity in the world, with a tropical rainforest, and has a lot of biodiversity, species only there, no more in other part of the world. So when you cut the land and devast the forest, a lot of excavation, consequently, we lost biodiversity, habitat, and so on. But the model of locks with different levels save other part of the problem is we have two oceans, Atlantic and Pacific, in different levels. But with the locks, we save the crosses of the seas. And they are different in the Pacific and the Atlantic. For that reason, the system of locks to maintain the no together these waters. But so far, until this moment, Panama Canal used sweet water to pass the ships, no? Without and all this sweet water goes to the sea. That's okay. But the new canal, I mean, the expansion, will reuse the water to go back the sweet water to the Lago Gatun Lake. This system, if is a good because recycled water, has a little risk of salinization of the Lago Gatun. And this is a problem because the Lago Gatun is not just for the transit of the ships, even to consume water for the population. So we have a problem in a city with 1.5 million people in the city that needs that water. And even we need more water because we will have more chips and bigger.
That's really fascinating to think. It's really only 50 miles long, is this right? The canal itself. And yet the very different biodiversity either end, on the Pacific end and on the Atlantic end. Fascinating.
It's like a 1 hour travel, but you have five types of rainforest in the middle.
I'm speaking with Panama City Vice Mayor and environmentalist Risa Banfield and Harvard Business School professor and historian Noel Maurer about the Panama Canal as we pass its 100th anniversary. We'll talk with University of Maryland historian Julie Green right after a short break. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. I've been speaking with Harvard Business School professor Noel Maurer and Panama City Vice Mayor and environmentalist Risa Banfield about the 100th anniversary of the Panama Canal. We were also joined by University of Maryland Latin America labor historian Julie Green. Julie, I'd like to turn to you because not only do we know about the engineering capacity here, the incredible accomplishments, the economic impact, the politics history. I want to get back to this whole notion of the political impact, the environmental impact, but the human impact was also significant. What I don't think we think about is there were tens of thousands of people that were involved in building this canal and the impact on their lives. I mean, Noel mentioned illness, for example, you know, the way in which the conditions in which they live. This is what you've been working on. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think that part of it is fascinating. You know, the canal is known for the medical achievements and the engineering and the technological. But I take my lead from the chief engineer, George Washington Gettles, who really more than any other single person was on the ground achieving this incredible thing. And he once said that even though people talk about the medical miracles and the engineering, really none of that was new in the canal zone. We were applying known principles that had been used elsewhere in Cuba or India or Egypt. He said, my greatest achievement and what made the construction possible was figuring out how to rule over and preserve order in the canal zone and in the Republic of Panama. The human dimension of it was incredible. As many as 45,000 workers on the canal at a given time. The overall estimates of migration to the Isthmus of Panama is over 100,000 people over the 10-year period it took to build the canal. And so to provide for life there, to make people feel calm and to keep them there and to manage the labor of all these workers who came from about 100 different countries around the world. The U.S. officials from Gettles on down had to really struggle to create policies, to create the infrastructure of what they considered civilized life. And one of the keys to how they did it was a system of racial segregation similar to Jim Crow in the U.S. South, the so-called silver and gold payroll system, whereby white workers were on the gold payroll, made much higher wages than they would have in the United States, whereas the silver roll, predominantly people of African descent from the Caribbean, lived on much lower wages, lived in much more shabby housing without screens on the windows, et cetera. And yet the catch, the interesting thing is, although it was kind of a biracial Jim Crow segregation system, the demographics in the canal zone were so complex that a two-toned system didn't work very well. You had Spaniards coming in who were considered semi-white, and the officials couldn't figure out where they should be within the segregation system. So a lot of the history of the actual construction was about workers kind of coping with these conditions, resisting or challenging them, and officials finding that they had to revise and tweak their policies over and over again.
Well, it's really a fascinating story. Your book tells us about the segregation, as you mentioned, the discrimination, the exploitation. Really, really interesting. Well, in the last couple minutes that we have, Noel, I just want to come back to kind of the present day. So bring us up to the canal being turned over to Panama in 99 and kind of where we are today with the canal.
That's actually an easy question to answer. It's been great, to the surprise of many, many people. So the canal is finally handed over to the Panamanians in 1999. Since then, the canal has only continued to improve in pretty much every measure. Efficiency, profitability. I mean, it's now spinning off billions of dollars to the Panamanian treasury every year.
Why did we turn it over? I mean, this became a bit of a political issue, right, with the presidential election, Reagan versus Carter. I mean, Carter handed it back to the Panamanians. Why did we even do that?
Because it had become entirely worthless to the United States by then. Basically, two things. One is nobody's shipping oil from California to the East Coast by the 1970s. By the 1970s, the Panama Canal is handling two kinds of cargo. One is wheat coming from the Midwestern United States. And by then, Midwestern farmers are entirely indifferent between shipping it out to Seattle and then taking it across the Pacific or shipping it down to the coast. This is because you've got the dieselization of railroads, which greatly dropped railroad costs inside the United States after World War II. The other thing is you've got Japanese cargoes coming in from Japan to the East Coast of the United States. Well, if a hypothetical independent Panama Canal Authority decided to jack up rates, that's only going to hurt Japanese producers, and they don't have a terribly big constituency in the United States. Similarly, the canal has no strategic purpose. During World War II, 7 warships moved through the canal in the first year of the war. Only one, the Wasp, was in any battles at all where a 19-day delay would have affected anything. And that was the Battle of Guadalcanal, where the U.S. had the initiative and could choose when to start the attack. So strategically, it had proved worthless in World War II. Certainly by the time, you know, you've got the Cold War going on, no one really cares about the Panama Canal. So its economic utility has gone away. It's losing money. The U.S. is running it terribly. Accident rates are skyrocketing. It's a drain on the treasury. There'd be no damage to the U.S. if the Panamanians jacked up rates. There was no reason to keep it. Except national pride. And it became a political football for purposes of national pride.
Well, it certainly is interesting to think about how, you know, turning over something so significant to us. But at the same time, today, and Raisa, you alluded to this, the Panama Canal being expanded, clearly not big enough for all of the the cargo ships that are coming through now. So definitely interesting to see how the Panamanians have handled it and turned it into a very profitable enterprise for them. So thank you for your work and for being with us today on Worldviews.
Thank you for your interest.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Noel Maurer, Raisa Banfield, and Julie Green. You can find more information online at kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews through a collaborative partnership with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Hallie Arias handled our digital efforts this week. Symphony Swift researches the interviews and books our guests, and our program is produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Grelott.